This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, February 18th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. After the death on Saturday of Justice Antonin Scalia, Republican senators vowed not to confirm any replacement nominated by President Obama. On Tuesday, Obama spoke about his right to do so.
The Constitution is pretty clear about what is supposed to happen now. When there is a vacancy on the Supreme Court, the President of the United States is to nominate someone. The Senate is to consider that nomination, and either they disapprove of that nominee or that nominee is elevated to the Supreme Court. Historically, this has not been viewed as a question.
Jeffrey Toobin joins me to discuss the politics in and about the court. Jeff, Obama called Scalia a giant of the Supreme Court on Tuesday. That's a term that can cut both ways. How important was he in shaping the court's jurisprudence and its politics?
Well, I think more important in the latter than the former, but very important. I really do think Justice Scalia is one of the handful of most influential justices in the entire history of the court. But it's an ambiguous legacy. I mean, on the significant side is that he is responsible for two schools of thought that have been enormously influential. One is originalism, which is the idea that the Constitution should be interpreted in accord with the wishes of the framers of the document in the late 18th century. And second, what's known as textualism, which is less high profile, but refers to how statutes, laws, should be interpreted according only to their terms, not to what the legislative history, what the authors, the legislators might have intended the words to mean. But originalism in particular is very controversial, even among conservatives, but it is widely discussed, widely believed in the broader political community. And it's Scalia's theory, and most Supreme Court justices don't have that kind of influence.
His decisions have also been seen, like those of any justice, for that matter, as being deeply informed by politics.
No Supreme Court justice, Antonin Scalia included, can divorce their legal views from their political views. But to take his views at face value, the most obvious originalist analysis says the framers of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights did not think they were giving their views on a woman's right to an abortion. They did not think they were protecting gay people from discrimination. Accordingly, an originalist says, the Constitution does not protect a woman's right to choose an abortion, does not protect gay rights. And that view, very pungently and frequently expressed by Scalia and his admirers, is one that has a lot of sway. It has generally not gained five votes on the court. And I think that's one point that's very important to keep in mind about Scalia, is that a purely originalist view of the Constitution is not the law of the land and never has been. And I think when weighing his influence, that's a very important factor to keep in mind.
I want to ask you about Bush v. Gore, which you've written about a great deal and is, I believe, one of the most famous or notorious, depending on your perspective, decisions in court history.
No question. The question is it consistent with an originalist view?
Yes, and explain the political nature of the decision.
Well, just to go to the legal setting of Bush v. Gore, the Florida Supreme Court had said, according to the Florida Constitution and the Florida laws, the vote should be recounted in Florida. The Supreme Court reversed that ruling 5-4, saying that separate recounts in separate counties violated the rights to equal protection under the 14th Amendment guaranteed to George W. Bush. The critique of Bush v. Gore, which I share, is that the originalists and other conservatives on the court had always said that the Equal Protection Clause, which was designed to protect the rights of African Americans, should be interpreted narrowly. And here you had this white presidential candidate with a very novel claim that his rights were being violated simply by having Florida recount the votes according to its own laws. the accusation is that the five justices in the majority were acting more out of a political desire to see George Bush elected president than consistent with their otherwise strongly felt views about how the Constitution should be interpreted.
And the idea that the Supreme Court determined the fate of the election was utterly unprecedented, and one would think in opposition to what the Constitution says.
In fairness to the court, the situation was extremely novel, and most elections don't wind up in the Supreme Court because they're not that close. But once it got to the court, one would think that believers in judicial restraint and states' rights, like Justice Scalia claimed to be, would have said, look, this is a matter for Florida to decide according to Florida's own laws. That's what they usually say in other settings. And I think they were fairly criticized for a very aggressive tack to protect the rights of George W. Bush. And I think the Bush v. Gore is a very low point in the history of the court.
And what about his dissent on the Affordable Care Act?
Well, you know, there were two Affordable Care Act decisions, both of which he voted in the minority against the Obama administration. The first, where they said the law was constitutional. The second, where they interpreted the law to allow the exchanges to continue to function. And again, the court, ever since the days of Chief Justice John Marshall, has always taken an expansive view of the power of Congress to regulate commerce, especially since the New Deal. And if you believe in the precedence of the court, a law that regulates approximately 15% of the American economy seems the very definition of regulating interstate commerce. But the court said, no, it was an overstep of the court's commerce power. But Chief Justice Roberts, along with the four liberals, said it was legitimate under the taxing power. Scalia said that it wasn't. And I think his last few years on the bench were very much a time when his politics came to the floor, whether it was about Obamacare or immigration or separation of powers or church and state issues. His status as a really angry conservative seemed to trump his constitutional erudition.
What about the separation of powers and how Republicans have been turning to the courts and ultimately the court to bypass Obama's veto power? And what cases are coming up that fall into that category?
This has really come up a lot. This is one of the main themes of the last 7 years at the Supreme Court, is that President Obama, especially in his first 2 years in office, passed a number of laws with a Democratic Congress, and then, after the House went Republican, made aggressive but traditional use of his power to pass executive orders, often in the environmental area, but also when it comes to immigration. And the conservative movement has been very aggressive in challenging those moves in the court. And perhaps the most high-profile cases that are currently before the court unresolved involve the president's attempt to limit expulsions from the United States for people who were not in the country legally. And also, in a really shocking thing, which may be Justice Scalia's very last act as a Supreme Court justice, the court preemptively, before even a lower court addressed the issue, put a hold on the president's climate change regulations, something that's really just enormously important and very unusual procedurally, indicative of a real hostility.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
What about the current battle over Obama's determination to send the Senate a candidate for confirmation? As he noted at the top of the program, this is a right of his under the Constitution. What's the Republican strategy here? We've seen Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley now saying, contrary to Mitch McConnell, that he wants to see a nominee before issuing a rejection, at least.
Yeah, I think it's important in discussing this issue to start at the ending. The ending is, President Obama will not get a nominee confirmed in his remaining 11 months in office. The important number to consider there is 14. There are 46 Democrats in the Senate and 54 Republicans. In order to beat a filibuster, which is routine now in the Senate, the Democrats would need 14 Republicans to join them to get to 60. It is simply inconceivable in the current United States Senate that there would be 14 Republicans who would let President Obama appoint a new justice to the Supreme Court. So it's just not going to happen. Now, along the way, there are questions that are unresolved. Will President Obama's nominee get a hearing? Will senators announce their objection, as Mitch McConnell did, before Obama even nominates someone? Those questions are interesting and perhaps politically significant, but I think it's important to keep the main point in mind, which is Obama will not get someone confirmed.
He admitted in his comments, I believe on Tuesday, that he himself objected to the nomination of Samuel Alito in 2008. How do you see him pursuing this issue, given the fact that it is an election year? He wants a Democratic president to succeed him. His entire legacy is at stake, given the next nominee.
Just to isolate why this Supreme Court seat is so important, it's not just because Antonin Scalia is a historic figure. It's because for really a generation, and maybe two generations, the Supreme Court has had five conservatives and four liberals. If President Obama or his Democratic successor appoint a Democratic successor to Scalia, the court would flip to five liberals. And that would be an earthquake. Everybody who follows the court knows that. So the Republicans, who object to virtually everything President Obama does on principle, are even more likely to fight him on this point. That's the setting. But in terms of the politics, the president has to recognize that this is a political act as much as it is a nomination to the Supreme Court. It's not going to be a white man. It's not going to be someone who is a novel choice, like any sort of politician. I think it's going to be an impeccably qualified minority man or woman who is going to be a symbol of Democratic aspirations and Obama hopes Republican obstruction.
There's been a lot of debate. Well, will he choose, you know, a left-wing candidate for political reasons? That seems highly unlikely, given Obama's political leanings. I mean, who do you think might be among the top-tier candidates?
I initially thought that Sri Srinivasan, who is a new judge on the D.C. Circuit, would be a likely nominee. He would be a very likely nominee if there was a chance that he might be confirmed. He is impeccably credentialed according to the traditional qualifications. He was confirmed unanimously by the Senate. He would be the first Indian American ever on the court. I do think, though, that as I have studied the issue more carefully, he has a lot of opponents in the labor movement, in the left of the Democratic Party. His most celebrated case as a private lawyer was representing the former CEO of Enron. In the current political moment, that's not a great asset in the party that Bernie Sanders presumes to run. So I think it is more likely to be perhaps Paul Watford, an African-American judge on the Ninth Circuit, former clerk for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, former federal prosecutor, who doesn't have that kind of baggage and also is a representative of a key Democratic constituency. I think Jane Kelly, a judge on the Eighth Circuit, a former public defender. There's a judge on the Ninth Circuit named Jacqueline Nguyen, who came as a refugee from Vietnam. I think those figures represent more of the point Obama is trying to make rather than sort of a traditional, heavily qualified judge who's not going to get confirmed anyway.
And how big a role do you think this is going to play in the election? Is this an issue that the American public is clamoring to hear more about?
No, but I think it's symbolic of how our politics have evolved over the past decade or so. You know, when we talked about presidential elections in recent years, it was all about, you know, what motivates swing voters? What's going to move soccer moms or security moms or, you know, the voters who might go either way? The parties have determined that that group is smaller and smaller, and the way to win presidential elections is to motivate your base. Swing voters, in my experience, don't care much about the Supreme Court, but the base does, and it could be a way for both sides of motivating their base. You know, I do think as we get into the fall, as we get into the real crunch time, whoever the two candidates are, the court will likely fade as an issue, and the issues like the economy and national security and the personality of the candidates, sort of the traditional big issues, will come to the fore. But far more than any presidential election that I've ever covered or even been alive for, because of this vacancy, the Supreme Court will certainly be an issue, and the candidates will be asked about it. They'll be asked about it in debate. So bigger than ever before, but ultimately not dispositive.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer and the author most recently of The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.
You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts in the iTunes store. You can find past episodes of The New Yorker Out Loud, The Political Scene, and The New Yorker's fiction and poetry podcasts at NewYorker.com/podcast. The weekly audio edition of The New Yorker is available at audible.com.